term that most people know, especially young guys that are on internet and social media. It normally means you swipe right if you like something, you swipe left if you don't. It's used a lot on dating apps. So if the person or the thing is something you like or interested in, you swipe right. If it's something you're not interested in, then you swipe left. And you'll see why the message is titled that. When we're talking about social media, we've been talking about how we get broken through different things, generational curses, through spiritual forces, and through life experiences. And there's something else that's fairly new in the last 20 years, and that's technology and social media. Do you know that there are 500 million tweets every single day? 500 million tweets every day. There are 330 million active Twitter users. 330 million, that's the population of the United States of America. So that's how many people are actively using Twitter on a regular basis around the world. Then Instagram. Instagram has over 1 billion, with a B, 1 billion users. And they spend about an average of 53 minutes a day on Instagram. That's an average. So, you know, some are spending a whole lot more time. And then TikTok, that's relatively new, but it's very popular now. TikTok, and this is just in the United States alone, 53% of those that are on TikTok are under 29 years, or between 10 and 29, 53%. And in the United States, 130 million Americans are active on TikTok. That's about 39% of the country. But then we get to Facebook. Now, Facebook's been around longer than most of these other ones, and 69% of Americans, 69% of Americans are on Facebook. Most of you have probably already been on it today and liked something or posted something or shared something. And 73% of adults in the United States are on Facebook every day. And I says adults because once adults started to use Facebook, a lot of the young people decided they didn't want to use it anymore. It wasn't cool if mom and dad were using it, so they use other things like Snapchat and Instagram. 73% of adults. We are more connected now than we have ever been in history. And it's a good thing, especially for us being like a missionary church. It's great to be able to see what the missionaries are doing, what those who have left from our church, like the Ingracias and others, what they're doing in Bungalow Hospital or the prayer requests are immediately shared, and we know how to pray. It's great for that reason. It's also good for connecting with family. My mom lives in Florida. I have a sister in Atlanta, and it's easy to see what's going on and what they're doing and what their weekend plans are and where they're going for dinner, right? And the pictures of their meal. It's good to see all of those things. And for those who live further away, like my family in Costa Rica and Central America, and being able to keep up with them and my aunt and my cousins. So it's good. We're connected more than we've ever been before. Yet we are more isolated and feel more alone than ever before. There's a study that came out in 2018, so this was 2019, March 2019. This was before the pandemic. So before the pandemic, the study came out in March 2019 saying that depression and anxiety were skyrocketing. That's the title of it, skyrocketing. In particular, among 20-year-olds at a rate much, much higher than those a decade ago, 10 years ago, among the same age group. So it's skyrocketing. In 2019, also before the pandemic, over 47,000 people took their own lives. That was in 2019. It has increased over 30% since 1997, around there. Between then and now, it's increased over 34%. So we're more connected, yet more and more people are depressed and anxious and see no way out, and even decide to take their own lives. There's a video that I want to show you, because there's a guy named Simon Sinek. He is a cultural anthropologist, which means he studies people, he studies culture, and he was asked about just, you know, millennials and the younger generation, and he says some things that are incredibly insightful. And I wanted to have him speak, one, because he's an expert in this area. He's not a Christian. As far as I know, he might be, but he doesn't speak or write from a biblical perspective. He doesn't quote scripture. But what he says is powerful. And I wanted everyone, especially the younger, especially the teenagers that are in the room, to also listen, because I think, you know, sometimes you think, well, that's just a pastor talking. There's more to it than that. So I want you to watch with me Simon Sinek talking about what this generation is facing.
The generation that we call the millennials, too many of them grew up subject to, not my words, failed parenting strategies, you know, where, for example, they were told that they were special all the time. They were told that they could have anything they want in life just because they want it, right? They were told, some of them got into honors classes not because they deserved it, but because their parents complained. And some of them got A's not because they earned them, but because the teachers didn't want to deal with the parents. Some kids got participation medals. You got a medal for coming in last, right? Which the science we know is pretty clear, which is it devalues the medal and the reward for those who actually work hard, and it actually makes the person who comes in last feel embarrassed because they know they didn't deserve it, so it actually makes them feel worse, right? So you take this group of people, and they graduate school, and they get a job, and they're thrust into the real world, and in an instant, they find out they're not special, their moms can't get them a promotion, that you get nothing for coming in last, and by the way, you can't just have it because you want it. Right? And in an instant, their entire self-image is shattered. And so you have an entire generation that's growing up with lower self-esteem than previous generations. The other problem, to compound it, is we're growing up in a Facebook, Instagram world. In other words, we're good at putting filters on things. We're good at showing people that life is amazing even though I'm depressed. So you have an entire generation growing up with lower self-esteem than previous generations, right? Through no fault of their own. Through no fault of their own, right? They were dealt a bad hand, right? Now, let's add in technology. We know that engagement with social media and our cell phones releases a chemical called dopamine. That's why when you get a text, it feels good, right? So, you know, we've all had it where you're feeling a little bit down or feeling a bit lonely, and so you send out 10 texts to 10 friends, you know, hi, 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 because it feels good when you get a response, right? Right? It's why we count the likes. It's why we go back 10 times to see if my Instagram is growing slower. Did I do something wrong? Do they not like me anymore? Right? The trauma for young kids to be unfriended, right? Because we know when you get it, you get a hit of dopamine, which feels good. It's why we like it. It's why we keep going back to it. Dopamine is the exact same chemical that makes us feel good when we smoke, when we drink, and when we gamble. In other words, it's highly, highly addictive. Right? We have age restrictions on smoking, gambling, and alcohol, and we have no age restrictions on social media and cell phones, which is the equivalent of opening up the liquor cabinet and saying to our teenagers, hey, by the way, this adolescence thing, if it gets you down. But that's basically what's happening. That's basically what's happening, right? That's basically what happened. You have an entire generation that has access to an addictive, numbing chemical called dopamine through social media and cell phones as they're going through the high stress of adolescence. Why is this important? Almost every alcoholic discovered alcohol when they were teenagers. When we're very, very young, the only approval we need is the approval of our parents. And as we go through adolescence, we make this transition where we now need the approval of our peers. Very frustrating for our parents, very important for us. It allows us to acculturate outside of our immediate families into the broader tribe. Right? It's a highly, highly stressful and anxious period of our lives, and we're supposed to learn to rely on our friends. Some people, quite by accident, discover alcohol and numbing effects of dopamine to help them cope with the stresses and anxieties of adolescence. Unfortunately, that becomes hardwired in their brains, and for the rest of their lives, when they suffer significant stress, they will not turn to a person, they will turn to the bottle. Social stress, financial stress, career stress, that's pretty much the primary reasons why an alcoholic drinks. Right? What's happening is because we're allowing unfettered access to these dopamine-producing devices and media, basically it's becoming hardwired. And what we're seeing is as they grow older, too many kids don't know how to form deep, meaningful relationships. Their words, not mine. They will admit that many of their friendships are superficial. They will admit that their friends, that they don't count on their friends, they don't rely on their friends, they have fun with their friends, but they also know that their friends will cancel on them if something better comes along. Deep, meaningful relationships are not there because they never practice the skill set, and worse, they don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress. So when significant stress starts to show up in their lives, they're not turning to a person, they're turning to a device, they're turning to social media, they're turning to these things which offer temporary relief. We know, the science is clear, we know that people who spend more time on Facebook suffer higher rates of depression than people who spend less time on Facebook. Right? These things balanced. Alcohol is not bad, too much alcohol is bad. Gambling is fun, too much gambling is dangerous. Right? There's nothing wrong with social media and cell phones. It's the imbalance. Right? If you're sitting at dinner with your friends and you're texting somebody who's not there, that's a problem. That's an addiction. If you're sitting in a meeting with people you're supposed to be listening to and speaking, and you put your phone on the table, face up or face down, I don't care, that sends a subconscious message to the room that you're just not that important to me right now, right? That's what happens. And the fact that you cannot put it away is because you are addicted, right? If you wake up and you check your phone before you say good morning to your girlfriend, boyfriend, or spouse, you have an addiction. And like all addiction, in time, it'll destroy relationships, it'll cost time, and it'll cost money, and it'll make your life worse, right? So you have a generation growing up with lower self-esteem that doesn't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress. Right? Now you add in the sense of impatience. Right? They've grown up in a world of instant gratification. You want to buy something, you go on Amazon, it arrives the next day. You want to watch a movie? Log on and watch a movie. You don't check movie times. You want to watch a TV show? Binge. You don't even have to wait week to week to week. Right? I know people who skip seasons just so they can binge at the end of the season. Right? Instant gratification. You want to go on a date? You don't even have to learn how to be like, hey. You don't even have to learn and practice that skill. You don't have to be the uncomfortable one who says yes when you mean no and says no when you mean no and yes when you... You don't have to swipe right. Bang, I'm a stud. Right? You don't even have to learn the social coping mechanisms. Right? Everything you want, you can have instantaneously. Everything you want, instant gratification. Except job satisfaction, and strength of relationships, there ain't no app for that. They are slow, meandering, uncomfortable, messy processes. And so I keep meeting these wonderful, fantastic, idealistic, hardworking, smart kids. They've just graduated school. They're in their entry-level job. I sit down with them and I go, how's it going? They go, I think I'm gonna quit. I'm like, why? They're like, I'm not making an impact. I'm like, you've been here 8 months. You know? It's as if they're standing at the foot of a mountain. And they have this abstract concept called impact that they want to have in the world, which is the summit. What they don't see is the mountain. I don't care if you go up the mountain quickly or slowly, but there's still a mountain. And so what this young generation needs to learn is patience. That some things that really, really matter, like love or job fulfillment, joy, love of life, self-confidence, a skill set, any of these things, all of these things take time. Sometimes you can expedite pieces of it, but the overall journey is arduous and long and difficult. And if you don't ask for help and learn that skill set, you will fall off the mountain. Or you will, the worst case scenario, and we're already seeing it, the worst case scenario is we're seeing an increase in suicide rates. We're seeing an increase in this generation. We're seeing an increase in accidental deaths due to drug overdoses. We're seeing more and more kids drop out of school or take leaves of absence due to depression. Unheard of. This is really bad. The best case scenario, those are all bad cases, right? The best case scenario is you'll have an entire population growing up and going through life and just never really finding joy. They'll never really find deep, deep fulfillment in work or in life. They'll just waft through life and it'll be just, it's fine. How's your job? It's fine. It's the same as yesterday. How's your relationship? It's fine. Like, that's the best case scenario. We're getting them in our companies, and we now have to pick up the slack. We have to work extra hard to figure out the ways that we build their confidence. We have to work extra hard to find ways to teach them the social skills that they're missing out on. There should be no cell phones in conference rooms. None. Zero. And I don't mean the kind of like sitting outside waiting to text. I mean, like, when you're sitting and waiting for a meeting to start, nobody goes, this is what we all do. We all sit here and wait for the meeting to start. Meeting starting? Okay. And we start the meeting. No, that's not how relationships are formed. Remember we talked about it's the little things? Relationships are formed this way. We're waiting for a meeting to start and we go, how's your dad? I heard he was in the hospital. Oh, he's really good. Thanks for asking. He's actually at home now. Oh, I'm really glad. That was really amazing. I know, it was really scary for a while. That's how you form relationships. Hey, did you ever get that report done? Oh my God, no, I didn't. I'll help you out. Can I help you out with that? Really? That's how trust forms. Trust doesn't form at an event, in a day. Even bad times don't form trust immediately. It's the slow, steady consistency. And we have to create mechanisms where we allow for those little innocuous interactions to happen. And so it's like an alcoholic. The reason you take the alcohol out of the house is because we cannot trust our willpower. We're just not strong enough. But when you remove the temptation, it actually makes it a lot easier. But if you don't have the phone, you just kind of enjoy the world. And that's where ideas happen. The constant engagement is not where you have innovation and ideas. Ideas happen when our minds wander and we go, and you see something, I bet they could do that. That's called innovation, right? But we're taking away all those little moments, right? You should not, and none of us should charge our phones by our beds. We should be charging our phones in the living rooms, right? Remove the temptation. You wake up in the middle of the night because you can't sleep, you won't check your phone, which makes it worse. But if it's in the living room, it's relaxed, it's fine. But it's my alarm clock. Buy an alarm clock. They cost $8, right?
These are the three things that he mentioned, if you want to write those down. The impact, low self-esteem, lack of deep, meaningful relationships, impatience, and instant gratification. And it's crazy how we can listen to him and realize just how true what he's saying is, yet at the same time, how unaware we are of the impact. And he talked about the constant bombardment. And that's why the Bible talks about the day of rest, the Sabbath, the rhythms of being alone with God, of solitude, of quiet. Because, you know, back in the day when you had problems, school was stressful. High school is stressful. Middle school is stressful. But you'd go home and you wouldn't hear from those people until the next day. Now it's constant. Here in, I'm going to show you a couple of graphs. One of them is from right here in the Finger Lakes region. That's why I'm sharing this one, because this shows the progression of anxiety and depression. The first line, the top line, is among African Americans. This is in the Finger Lakes region. So you can see how much it has been increasing among African Americans. The second line is among Latinos, and the third line is among whites. You can see for each demographic, it's increasing. This is nationally since 1981. You can see it increased some until 1996, and then '86, and then it was kind of steady up until 2000, 2001, and then it starts to steadily increase. There are some things that have occurred, like during that time. Right here is the internet. The internet was around 1992, but around 1996, 97 is when it really became popular, because we went from having one TV in our room or in our home. Remember the days when there was one TV with one, like five or six channels? And anyone, I know the kids are like, what? That's crazy. Yeah, just like one TV with five or six channels. And that means even though there was a TV, the family had to come together to watch TV. And if anyone wanted to watch something else, you had to get permission from everybody else. Can I change the channel? Remember the fights with your brothers and sisters because you changed the channel? And then we went from one TV to cable television with hundreds of channels and smaller TVs in every bedroom. And then the family started to separate. And then we went to computers and the internet, which took us from hundreds of channels to millions of websites. Millions of websites at our fingertips. And at first, in 1996 and 7, I remember when the internet was growing and all the websites were there, and now we had browsers. And back then, it was just chat rooms. Remember the chat rooms? That was the way you met people and connected with people and shared opinions and ideas, and could waste so much time meeting people and talking to people and getting into trouble. But then The iPhone came out in 2007, and that put that internet and those millions of websites from your desktop into your hand and your pocket. So now everyone has access to it 24 hours a day. It's crazy. Then Facebook came out right after that. I went back and looked at the very first picture I posted to see when it was that I joined, and I think it was somewhere, I think it might have been 2009 or somewhere around there is when it came out. I think mine was 2011. I waited a little bit, but that's when Facebook really took off. Twitter was around the same time. There was something else that happened, though, that was significant, and that was 9/11, right there, when it starts to climb again. So it's not just technology, but technology obviously has a factor in this. And this ends, this goes through 2016. So we can always obviously put another line for 2020 and the pandemic. I think we can expect to see those climb even higher over the last, as a result of the pandemic and what we've gone through the last year. And it is crazy how much things have changed. Because, like I said, now everyone has them in their own hands, and it wasn't like that before. I remember when there was just one phone in the house, and the phone would ring. And if it rang after 9 o'clock, we would all be like, who's calling? You know, my mom and dad would be like, who's calling? Who's calling right now at 9 o'clock at night? And we were all hoping, I hope it's not one of my friends, because then, oh, no. But there was that idea, who's calling at 9 o'clock at night? Now we and our kids have phones, and we have them with us in our rooms, and we're texting and receiving messages all the time. And it's crazy because there is no way that when I was a kid, I could go to my parents and say, hey, is it okay if I talk to this girl at 3 o'clock in the morning? She's just going to come by, and she's going to come into my room, and we're going to sit down, and we're going to talk at 3 o'clock in the morning. No. But by having access to anyone, anywhere in the world, at any time, we're allowing people into our kids' bedrooms, so to speak, at all hours of the night. And not only that, personal talking, but just all the impact, how this affects us. So what I want to give us three ways that we can swipe right. The first one is swipe right to be with the people that are right in front of you. Swipe right to be with the people that are right in front of you. We see these images all the time. I mean, we've seen them. They are us. The ones on the left there, that's us. Sitting at the dinner table, sitting at a restaurant with our friends, or even with our family. I mean, I've texted my kids in the house to let them know to come down to dinner. And but then when you put the phones down, look at the interactions that we can have when we swipe right, when we choose to interact with the people that are right in front of us. And it goes without saying, right, with those that are right there in front of us, engaging with them. Jesus, in John chapter 4, he goes with the disciples to the area of Samaria, and there's an encounter that he has with a woman at a well. Now, this was a woman who had a really hard, checkered life and past. She had been with 6 different men, couldn't hold a relationship down, and she was filled with shame. So she would go to the well to get water when nobody else was there. When you're filled with shame, you normally, you look down. You don't look up at people. You don't make eye contact. You just kind of look down. She probably just wanted to go get some water and leave. But Jesus engages her. Jesus looks up at her, and he talks to her. And she has an encounter with Jesus. And Jesus offers her living water that would refresh her soul, that would become like a spring inside of her. And she accepts this. Her heart is changed. And now this woman who wanted nothing more than to be alone goes running to the town and tells everybody and brings the entire town back to Jesus. And when they're coming back, the disciples have gotten back to Jesus. They're sitting there now with Jesus, and Jesus tells them, you say, you know, it's a few more months until the harvest. No, I tell you, lift up your eyes and look. The harvest is plentiful. And he was referring to the townspeople that were walking out to them. And he's telling them, guys, lift up your eyes, look. And I think that applies to us today because of how much we are looking down. And we can be in a room with people that are right there physically in the room, but yet we're not engaging them. We're looking down at our devices. And I think that applies to us to say, you know what? Lift up your eyes. Look at the people that are in the room with you. Look at the people that are sitting around the table with you. And engage them. And the reason it's so important is because we were created for meaningful relationships. Just like he said, we've lost the ability to develop deep, meaningful relationships. And that's a problem because we were created for deep, meaningful relationships. We shared this on Wednesday night at the class, that in Genesis chapter 1 is the story of creation. God creates day one. He creates the lights and the stars, and says, let there be light. And then at the end of day one, it ends with this phrase: God saw what he had created, and it was good. And the second day, God creates, and he looks at what he has created on day two, and he says, it's good. And day three, and day four, and day five, and day six, and God creates, and it's good. And then we get into chapter two, and for the first time in the Bible, it says that something is not good. Sin hasn't entered into the picture yet. There's no sin yet. In chapter 2, God looks at Adam and he says, it is not good for man to be alone. Now, the interesting thing is that he wasn't technically alone. I mean, God, he had God. But it seems like somehow God wasn't enough for Adam. And it seems blasphemous to say that we need more than God, because we've always been told that there's a God-shaped void inside of our hearts, that until God fills it, we'll never be whole, we'll never be full. And that's true. But there's another space in us that we need to fill that God can't fill, because he created us for meaningful relationships and community with each other, with trust, with real relationships, not superficial relationships. So God looks at Adam and says, it's not good for man to be alone. And he didn't create us to be alone. And we are alone. We struggle to find meaning. The second thing is, I want us to swipe right to do for and with others. Right? Not just to look at others, but to do for them. And because one of the things he mentioned in the video, and I know this to be true for my own kids, is the idea that they don't only feel alone, they feel like they don't have any real true friends. And my son would mention to me one time, he just said, I feel like I can't count on anyone. I feel like if I need someone, I don't know who to go to. And he had plenty of friends, and he played soccer in high school, and he played soccer in college, and he had plenty of friends, yet he didn't feel like if he needed them, he could count on them. So just like he mentioned in the video, the way you do that, the way you build trust, is by actually not putting people off, by not canceling on them, but by being there for them, doing for them, as opposed to just knowing them. The moment you realize, the moment you really start to feel satisfied is when your life starts to mean something for others, not just yourself. The moment you really start to feel satisfied is when your life is bigger than you now. It's not just all about you, but it's about others and helping others and serving others. I mean, yeah, it's good when people do stuff for you, but there's a joy and a satisfaction that comes from helping others. So helping others, swiping right to help and to do for other people and helping them. And, you know, it's my friend not too long ago, his father passed away just last month. And, you know, I could have just texted him. I could have, you know, just this, the heart emoji, the care emoji, the praying hands emoji. And I do that for a lot of people that I'm not that close with, but this is my friend. So I called him up. Because as many people would text him, or as many hearts you get, it's different when you hear someone's voice, when they call you. And I called him, and I didn't expect him to answer. It went to voicemail. I left him a message. I said, listen, you don't need to call me back. I just wanted you to hear my voice. Wanted to talk to you and let you know that I'm praying for you and I love you. And then hung up. He texted me later that night, and he says, it was so good to hear your voice. Right? So when we're talking about doing stuff for people, again, it's being there for them. And the third thing is swipe right to choose the hard path. Swipe right to choose the hard path. We talked about instant gratification and how people today, we're so used to wanting everything quickly. I love this picture that shows those two paths. And one on one side is so smooth. And the one on the other side is rugged and roots, and it's uphill. It's harder. And if you're standing there and you see the two, most of us would choose the left path. It's easy. But as he mentioned, in life, the things that really matter take effort, take time. Some of the best advice I got before I got married was to not expect to have everything my parents had immediately. Right? Realizing, okay, yeah, it makes sense. It took them 20 years, 30 years to accumulate the furniture that's in their house, the microwave, the appliances, the stuff. It took them 20 to 30 years to accumulate all that stuff. But I grew up with it, so I kind of get married and immediately think, okay, that's why we get into debt. I want to have all this stuff, and I want it now. I don't realize it's going to take me time to build that and develop that. It takes time. My daughter worked at a restaurant, and every 6 months they promote someone to assistant manager, and she applied for the promotion, and it got down between her and another girl, and they picked the other girl. And my daughter comes home and says, I'm going to quit. She was mad. She was upset. I'm going to quit. I'm like, because you didn't get it the first time around? You know, my son, youngest son, is applying at colleges, and I said, listen, college you want to go to, you might not get in. I'm not, you know, just wanting to prepare. You might not get in, but just realize most people don't get into the first try to the school they want to get into. But you can still get to college. You can still take some community courses and then transfer again. I'm just letting you know, because going back to my daughter, I realized how quickly when they don't get what they want the first time. So I told her, no, don't quit. Now you know what they're looking for. You know, you've gone through the interview process. You know the questions they're going to ask. You know better how to answer them. And over the next 6 months, before they promote someone else, you have a chance to do what needs to be done to show them, so that next time there's no question. It's like an automatic thing because you have done the work. Don't walk away now. But we do that so often. Look, Jesus puts it this way, talking about the kingdom. Go in through the narrow gate. The gate to destruction is wide, and the road that leads there is easy to follow. A lot of people go through that gate, but the gate to life is very narrow. The road that leads there is so hard to follow that only a few people find it. So teach them. You know, my parents, when in the 80s, we didn't have cell phones, but you remember pagers and beepers? So some of you guys remember what they are. Other guys are like, what is that? Pagers were, you know, you could get a call, and the number would show up, and then you'd have to go to a phone and then call the person back. So I remember I wanted a pager. I wanted a beeper. It was cool, right? You know, to have one. So I wanted one, and it was like $9.99, you know, like $10 a month was for the service, because you had to pay for the service. And it never, ever, ever occurred to me to ask my dad to buy or pay for my pager, my beeper. Never even thought of that. When I got my first car, I bought the car. I paid the insurance. Never even a thought that I would even dare to ask my dad, or that he should do that. And even though I learned that lesson about not wanting everything my dad had right after I got married, I didn't learn that lesson when it came to my kids. And when they got into high school and everybody else had phones, I got them a phone. I paid for the monthly service. When it was time for them to drive And I helped them with the car. I was paying the car insurance. And I'm realizing, because all of my kids are struggling also, some level with anxiety. Some of them more severe than others. And I'm realizing I robbed them of the opportunity to grow, to struggle, to know what it is to say, you want a cell phone? You get one when you can pay for it. You get a job, you get a cell phone. I'm not paying it for it. But you know, but at the same time, I wanted my kids to have things and unintentionally hurt them by giving them things without them having to earn them. So James puts it this way: consider it pure joy when you suffer trials or face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Romans says something similar, but I want to go to Romans because it says that, you know, James says that perseverance finishes its work so that you may be mature, complete, not lacking anything. See, it's James chapter 1, verse 4. Trials, struggles develop perseverance, which when they finish their work, you are mature and complete, not lacking anything. Romans puts it this way, talking about our faith. We have been justified with God. We have peace now with God. There's a relationship with God. In verse 2, right? Though through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace by which we now stand, and we boast of the hope of the glory of God. And then here he goes. Not only so, but we glory in our suffering because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character, and character, hope. And then he says, and hope does not disappoint. Right, does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. See, so he ties it in. He says, why? Yeah, the struggling and builds character and maturity, but the reason we're able to go through it is because of the love of God that has been poured out in us. It's because of the relationship that we have with the Father that sustains us and the relationships that we have with each other that get us through those trials. So, obviously, for the young people that are in here, the best thing is, you come to church on Sunday and you should be listening, obviously, to the Word of God, and you should be asking, Lord, what should I do with what I've just heard? Because that would be so much better than the parents to go home and say, okay, now what are we going to do? You go and pray. You listen to this and you start to ask yourself, okay, based on this, if this is something that's good, because remember what he said, it's like alcohol's not bad, but too much is bad. And social media isn't bad, but too much of it can be bad. Then what do I need to do to have balance? And when it comes to anxiety and depression, we have to realize that all of us, if it's this much of a pandemic, then obviously there are some in here today that are struggling with anxiety, struggling with meaning, struggling with life. So we can't talk about this and then just send you home. If you're struggling today with this, we want to pray for you. It's like we sang that song, he's the way maker. He makes that way. He makes that path. And that other path on the right is hard. It's rugged. It's difficult. It's challenging. But he's the one that leads us. He's already walked through that path for you. So will you pray with me? And I want to encourage you as we're praying, again, if you want to receive prayer, I invite you to come up and sit down in the front or kneel down to receive prayer today. To receive the love of the Father today, to receive the warm touch of a brother and sister in Christ. And even if you come up at first with your head bowed, we want you to leave looking up. Father, we pray for everyone here today and for those that are younger, that you would speak to their hearts and that they would show their maturity by making choices themselves that are good for them. and give us parents wisdom, especially those of us whose kids are already grown, already in that phase. It's like putting the genie back in the bottle. You can't put it back in. It's out. Technology is here. It's not going away. And give wisdom to those who have young children who have not yet been impacted, who still have the opportunity to develop and learn the skills to develop meaningful relationships and struggles. The wisdom to lead them. Bring healing, Father, into our hearts this morning. So I want us to stand as we sing this song. And again, I want to invite you forward.